Armand Damon.
Kevin Cova.
We're back at it.
We are.
Doesn't stop.
Doesn't stop. Also, this is our like third take of trying to start this episode.
No, but this is official.
Yes. Officially.
Yeah, it's officially begun. We are doing a live episode at Young Chicago Authors because we're in Young Chicago Authors gallery space with an artist who has blessed the space with his work on the wall. This is a very special show that we are in the midst of. I'm not 1,000% sure when this show will drop. So
it's not open yet?
No. Our show.
Oh, this episode.
Our corner store show that we do together. This podcast
Is that what this
we
is?
Do. Yes, okay.
I was just talking to Mike. Yeah, I don't know why.
But this is the show that is in the gallery currently is from an artist that we love dearly in the city of Chicago. Someone who is in this tradition that we talk a lot about at Young Chicago Authors. This tradition of realist working class portraiture. Someone who I think gives a lot of shine to the working person, puts on for an expanding, reclaimed canonical history of who we should be talking about as Americans. And the show that we are sitting in the midst of right now also introduces into his body of work a kind of a beautiful notion of surrealism. And so without further ado, I'm excited to hop into a conversation with our guest in the corner store this evening, Paul Branton. Paul, welcome to the corner store.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. Thanks for being here. We have some gifts for you right out the gate.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, we are, tonight for this special live edition of the Corner Store, we are sipping some fine beers from our sponsor, the Hopewell Brewing Company.
Indeed.
Are you enjoying? Are you, well,
no, I don't.
Okay, I
don't
know,
beer,
I know.
But they sound delicious.
I am enjoying a tasty lager.
And I have an IPA.
How is it? How you like
pretty
an IPA?
Tasty. I like it.
An IPA is more
hoppy,
sour.
Oh, I don't know.
Not
just
all the time. No. An IPA is an Indian Pale Ale. It's just the way that they make the beer. So
why is it called Indian Pale Ale?
It's racial.
It is.
I knew
very
you were going to say that.
It's a racial beer.
So I should be drinking it. Is what
I mean,
you're
it's actually
me.
Made for you.
I see.
We're also we have some incredible overachieving water from Essentia.
I love this water.
Me too. This is
gives you all your little
because of our good friend at Gallery F, Billy Craven. We are like halfway sponsored by Essentia Water.
Yo,
maybe we're going to work on that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're going to work on that. But Paul, for you, in addition to all these treats, Max, who is our snack tour in the corner store, snack tour. It's 2018.
Right. What's our gender non-binary?
Yeah, exactly. As the good homie Safiel Hillow says, gender is a galaxy.
So he could be a snacktress.
He could be whatever he wants to be. It's 2018.
What do you want to be?
He doesn't care. We have for you, though, Paul, we have some organic mango dried fruit snacks.
Okay.
I told Max that I thought you were a healthy individual, given all of the IG photos you take in the gym.
I am pretty healthy. Let me let you know something.
Okay.
And this is just within the last couple of months.
Okay.
They labeled me diabetic.
Ah, okay.
So.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm reading back of packages all the time.
Very important.
To see what the sugar content is.
Very
to
important.
See what the carbohydrates
are. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe those aren't the best snacks for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, these aren't the best. But
okay.
I can nibble a little bit of
no,
these.
No. We're going to fire Max. Yeah, you could. Yeah, but what about how do you feel about pistachio and almond blends, unsalted?
Love them.
Okay, good.
Good job, Max.
And I feel like yeah. Okay, good. So anyway, Paul, thank you, man, for being here. Now, Tara, you know Paul and I go way back. Paul also, blessed my book, A People's History of Chicago, with three portraits inside, as you well know, because you work so thoroughly on the book. But Paul, we're excited to talk with you, man. And some of the show that we are sitting in the midst of is also autobiographic. And even on the walls, you've put down additional stories that don't exist within the canvas itself, but do begin to get at some of your autobiography. So we want to go all the way back and just talk about where you come from.
Sure. Primarily, I was raised on the south side of Chicago. There was a couple of times where I lived in Whitewater, Wisconsin. Real quick. Like, really quick. Then my teenage years, I was in the South Suburbs in Country Club Hills.
Okay.
So outside of that, I stayed in Decatur for 4 years because I went to Millikan University. When I came home, I was in Schaumburg for a year because I was taking care of my little cousin. And then I was back in the city, back on 79th Street where I felt at home.
Well, as a kid, why all the moving around?
Some of it was the Whitewater, Wisconsin thing was because Wisconsin was giving like black people money like crazy to go to school. So my parents was like, hey, let's go back to school. My mom really was. So she went up there and we went in Whitewater this year, was going to school. My dad was halfway going to school. You know, my dad was, he was like the family man, but still had his foot in the streets all the time because he ran the streets when he was young. So some of it was that. Some of it was probably because my parents were young and didn't have a lot of money. And we stayed wherever we stayed. When I moved out of the city, that was more so my mother's decision because my father worked at Simeon.
What did he do there?
And my father was a custodian at Simeon for years. I grew up in Simeon. I remember how he felt when Benji got shot. I remember all that shit.
Wow.
It was
like
all that history was like firsthand within my household. And because of the stories that he would come home with, I was supposed to go to Morgan Park, and my mother didn't want me to go to any high school in Chicago. So we moved out to Country Club Hills, which was no damn better, because I went to Hillcrest. Like the first day of school I came home, I was like, hey, Ma, I saw somebody got their teeth knocked out today. Because we were in Country Club Hills. They were busing these kids in from Markham. Some kids at Markham went to Tinley Park. Some of them went to Hillcrest. You know, some rival gang stuff, and it just wasn't a pretty picture.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, well, all right, because I want to talk about, you know, who and how you were in high school. But as a kid, you know, given what you do now, when did you begin to draw?
I've been drawing since I can remember. But it was mostly, you know, as most kids, you would doodle cartoons. My very, very first, like, that I can remember, like, I'm extremely interested in art, it was because of my father's record collection. And he had a massive collection. So my mother was, like, into Motown stuff, and my father was into a lot of rock. He listened to everything. But in particular, there was a Marvin Gaye album, which the album cover was done by Ernie Barnes. And Ernie Barnes is the artist that did like all the good times, all the JJ stuff.
Yeah.
So I remember being fascinated that somebody created this world on this flat surface. So that was 78. I was born in 73. From that point on, I was like, I want to know how to do that. And I just started trying to create my own little worlds.
Do you have anybody in your family who was an artist? Or?
Not that I know of. My mother did tell me that she had interest in art. My mother is nowhere near an artist. I do have a cousin that's semi-artsy, but no, it's not something that ran in my family. Especially, and in our communities, you know, we didn't have a lot of original art. We weren't taken to museums and galleries. That's just not how our community was operating.
Music plays a big role in your work, and, you know, I want to think about 78, and then where were some of the first spaces where you heard in Chicago both house and also hip-hop?
Oh, snap. So hip-hop, I have like my very first piece of hip hop that I owned.
Let's talk about it.
It was, wow, let me think. It was either Houdini or, I mean, this is like early 80s. It might have been the Fat Boys, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was cassettes. And
do you know what those are, Tara? Should we?
You ever heard of
those? Yo, I'm not that young.
Okay.
Thank you.
Which I still have shoe boxes full of cassettes.
Yes. You don't listen to them still?
No, I just have them.
Yeah.
I have cassettes.
You don't got a boombox?
My mad CD collection. I used to do the Columbia House for a penny, get all these CDs.
Oh, yeah. That's how you ruin your credit as a kid, though, isn't it? Or, like, I used to sign up my neighbors.
Oh, I would use all kind of names.
Yes, and get exactly. All kind of, yeah.
To do what?
You would get, like, what, 10 CDs for a penny or something,
yeah,
like 10 that.
Yeah, 10 CDs for a penny, then they sign you up, and then once a month they ship you something, and if you don't ship it back, like, right away, they're like, all right, you owe me $50.
But then you could get good and, like, you could, like, well, with the, because there was a cassette program as well.
I was getting cassettes before they transitioned to CD.
Yeah, yeah, because you could bootleg the cassettes in the back. Yeah. But we would just sign up fake people. They would
charge some other people.
Yeah, and then it would just, like, get you, like, 50 cassettes at your doorstep.
I don't know how it worked, but I had a massive music collection from BMG. Big up to BMG.
Limitations, Mr. They might come Columbia.
I mean, I guess we would do that at the library and burn the CDs and then give them back.
Yeah.
And then at some point they put something on the CD where you couldn't burn it, which was weak as hell.
That is weak.
But so I understand.
But that's a good era. I mean, because, you know, Paul and I are the same.
Olds.
Yes, we're the same olds.
Same
generations.
Did you used to record off the radio?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had, you know, for me, you know, I was in a spring and summer basketball league that was circulating JP Chill tapes, you know, and so that's the first place that I heard BDP was on one of those tapes. They had JP or somebody did a BDP mega mix on, you know, the HBK station late night, and that went in our small basketball circle went like viral kind of.
In those years. I remember, especially if you got hooked on that, which I did, it was hard to come across certain sounds and artists. And, yeah, you would get a tape that was dubbed and dubbed and dubbed and dubbed.
Yes.
And then finally you got a copy. And it's a shit copy, but you're glad that you had it and you rock with it. And, you know, if it snapped, you tape it back together and...
Yeah.
And keep it rolling.
Well, we also used to get bootlegs off of Maxwell Street, too.
Okay.
You know, that was when, I mean, and that was like, I don't know what iteration of, you know, from the original that it was, but there were tapes that were laid out on blankets. And that's how I got introduced to Ice Cube when he went solo and records like that, you know. But, I mean, but to your point, I mean, because there was a time when, like, there were so few, I felt, hip-hop kids in Chicago, in part because it was still a new cultural force, and also because Chicago was a city of house, but I felt you could ride the train and identify them, you know, and that's how I met a lot of young people when I was young who were in, because I'm like, I know that kid by the way they walk, dress, the bop on it. Like,
but what would you say to them?
I would ask if they listened to a particular record, or like I would see.
Or you
graffiti.
Put them on or something.
Yeah, or I would like. I was so hungry for people who wanted to have anything to do with the culture. And on the train, I would see people looking maybe at graffiti pieces. So I would ask if they were a writer, you know. But there was just like there was like a way, a vibe, you know, that you.
That's probably one of my biggest regrets. I never got into that part of the culture.
Which is interesting.
Right.
I
like to observe.
Yes.
I like to look at it. But I never, like, grabbed a can and then and went out at night and did my thing.
Well, you have to be a little, like, out of your mind to do so as well. You know, I mean, that is, because there is, especially for teens, I think that there is also, like, the, you know, anti-authoritarian fuck it factor that is involved in being a graffiti writer, too. Okay, but in high school, What kind of, you know, student and kid and artist were you in high school?
All right, this is who I was in high school. So I was the smart kid that hung out. Like, I had like all the honors classes and the AP classes, and I played sports. So I had like all my jock friends. And then after school, I was a smart kid that hung around with the thuggish kids. So I had a plethora, like, and I wouldn't say I was a chameleon, because I was always myself, but I was able to like navigate through like all these different type of kids. And I felt comfortable with all of them. So I was cool, like we can go to a math-a-thon and I can kill it.
Then you were a mathlete, that's what you're trying to say.
I was a mathlete, yeah.
They didn't give you shit for being a nerd?
No, not me.
That's cool.
Because I was...
He's a big dude, too.
Because yeah. No.
No?
Not then.
Okay.
I was same height,
okay.
but 100 pounds lighter.
Okay.
So I was like 6 feet, 120-something pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Something crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was tall and skinny. Pretty quiet, pretty funny. We were the table that used to, he was beatboxing earlier, but we used to like.
Shout out Ernie, the engineer, always for warming up the crowd.
So we were beating on a table and having ciphers in lunchtime.
Wait, did you rhyme?
A little bit.
You want. What did I say last time? You want to kick a verse?
No.
Quick 16.
Yeah, I wasn't nice like that.
Because I'm also
no, okay.
Old.
Yeah, I wasn't
I'm an
nice
old like
you're
that.
Old. Yeah, that's right.
But back then, that was just what we did.
Yeah. No, those are facts. So.
Did you play basketball?
I did play basketball after school. I never played for the school. I played football, ran track, played basketball. I mean, not basketball, baseball.
Damn near a question we have to ask.
Yeah.
Are you nice?
In basketball?
Yes.
I love basketball. But my knees are paying for it right now.
It's fair, yeah.
It's fair, yeah.
Yeah, I was the all day, every day in the park.
Oh, yeah.
On the hard surface. And
yeah, it takes a toll.
Yeah, they don't tell you that when you're young.
Yeah, for real.
How are your knees, Kevin?
They're okay. I mean, yeah, my knees aren't the issue. You know, it's more my like
your leg,
head, and my like back and
your head.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, it's neither here nor there. But all right. So, when did you begin in high school? Did you begin to take yourself more seriously as an artist, or when did that start to happen for you?
I was always into it. My art teacher was Dominique Falaschetti. And it was during that time when I noticed that what I was doing was far more advanced than what my peers were doing.
Shots.
And did it come off like that?
No, I'm kidding. Also, facts, too.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. No, I mean.
I mean,
yeah.
it was just something I noticed. And then, yeah. I mean, there was some kids that were nice, but. And then it got to a point where, so Mr. Falaschetti was like, yo, it was just one art class. He was like, I'm going to put you on this. I was in like two art classes per year, like one with everybody else and then like one, like just me and him, some special stuff. And I was messing with clay and sculpting. Wasn't nobody else doing that at that time. I was like, okay, I like this. And the way it made me feel, I was like, I want to do this forever.
What art were you paying attention to, or you know, who were you checking for? What were you consuming?
At that time, I really wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't studying other artists like that to say, hey, I like him, I like that. I was just, I was immersed in hip hop culture. And like to be truly honest with you, especially at that age, art was, you were either just trying to mimic what you saw, which I used to, my grandfather had this mad collection of National Geographics, which some of the best photographers worked for that publication, and I would ooh and ah over these pictures, and I would draw them and paint them. Then outside of that, I was still drawing cartoons at that time.
Well, also, where does, if at all, do comic books figure in? Because I know for so many of our era,
yeah,
you know, we had access to, I mean, cartoons and comics filter into so much of the visual space for hip hoppers generally, anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a generational thing or that's where we tended to look, but any of that for you?
Not as serious as some people, because I know people that are like real deep readers and collectors and keep their comics in the plastic sleeves, yeah. And I wasn't that guy. Although I did have a uncle that gave me a garbage bag full of old comics that dated back to like the 50s and 60s, which I should have kept, and I was dumb and I didn't. He's a Chicagoan, and he grew up here, and then he part of his practice, he was in New York for a while, and he ended his practice in California. And the mural thing, actually, this is when he was married to Elizabeth Catlett, and he spent some time in Mexico.
Yeah.
And that's when those artists down there turned him on to murals.
Right. So this is Diego Rivera and Siqueiros. Yes. And that's amazing. And then, of course, Margaret Burroughs spent some time there in part mm-hmm. because of Elizabeth. And so she brought a lot of that back to Chicago. So Charles White, who else is in your,
this is going to be kind of weird. So, like, the artists that I look up to are not necessarily visual artists. Richard Pryor comes to mind because he was a person that was able to take, like, just raw honesty and shit that would hurtful, but make it hilarious. So we're laughing and tears coming out of eyes out of stuff that is just horrific sometimes that he's talking about, right? Miles Davis is an artist that kept evolving. It wasn't just like, oh, that's Miles, I know Miles, this is what he does. No, this is what he was doing in this decade, and this is what he was doing in this decade, and this is what he was doing in this decade. It amazed me. Like, when I go back and I start listening and digging in it, when I was digging in his catalog when I was a late teenager, Francis Bacon.
I see that. Yeah, in your work.
I love Francis Bacon.
Yeah, me too.
Marcus Jansen is an artist that I love. Like right now, I'm like, he was here not too long ago, and I was supposed to go to the show at the Navy Pier Thursday, but I didn't go that Thursday night, and he was there, and I felt like a groupie, right? Mm-hmm. Straight up, like, because of technology, it's like I get to follow these people, and I don't necessarily have to be on the scene to like see their work and see what they're doing every day. Like, who among my peers?
Yeah, and who are you in conversation with, either actually or intellectually right now, you know, folks who...
Man, that's tough. Because it's a lot of people that I truly admire. And if I forget a name, then I don't know.
You want people to come back and take shots. Yeah. Like, that's fair. Yeah.
Like, yo, why didn't you mention...
Right, I know. Come on, man. I thought we were cool, Paul.
And I'm cool with everybody, except for one person.
You want to talk about that?
Kevin?
No.
Damn, Tom. Why you got to start beef? We're having a nice conversation.
Oh, no, I just had to butt in real quick.
we'll
talk about the show, though.
Let's do it, yeah.
I mean, so, you know, Do you always have text in your art galleries?
No, not no.
Not like directly on the wall.
Yeah.
Actually,
this is probably the first time I did that.
Did you know what you wanted to write, or are you just kind of freehand?
No,
freestyle. Well,
free write, yeah, freestyle.
Yeah, I came in here, hung the show, and then I came back and I wanted to freak that wall, right? I knew I wanted to paint this balloon. That's all I knew. So outside of painting this balloon, and I'm sitting in here, and I'm looking at the stuff, and it's making me think, and I just grabbed a Sharpie and I started writing. So it wasn't anything that was planned.
But the stories you're telling are very personal in this space, and so are the paintings also reflections of a kind of autobiography?
They are. So each one of these paintings, it represents a place I was living in Chicago or the Chicago area, how it made me feel, how did a black boy view black men at that time, what were they teaching me? And so I looked at it twofold. One was my eyes, like right now, looking back on it, and then I put myself in that kid's body, and like, what was my perspective at that point?
I see. Yeah, because that's when the introduction of the other smaller figures then enter the space. Yeah.
Yeah,
which is new for you,
somewhat.
Okay.
So a lot of my work, there are reoccurring themes of innocence and holding on to innocence or innocence lost. And as I was working on this body of work, it kept hitting me over the head, and it was something that was just resonating with me when I was working and thinking about, man, you remember on 110th and Wentworth, what was going on? How did you feel? And it was a lot of stuff that, looking back on it, as a child, it was what it was. It was just my environment. But looking back from adult eyes, I saw shit I shouldn't have saw, and I heard things I shouldn't have heard.
There's also a vulnerability, I mean, in the way that the figures are positioned in the paintings and the, I guess, kind of, I don't know what position you would call it. I mean, it's over there in that painting as well.
Yes.
Kind of like a fetal position, maybe?
Yes, almost, yeah.
What is...
So it a lot of these figures are unclothed. So it is a feeling like when I was working on it, it was like, here I am. You can see everything. I'm not hiding anything. Let's talk about everything. I don't care. I mean, who I am today is this entire journey, everything that happened to me, everything I've been through, everything I've seen. So that's why it is a vulnerability to a lot of the work.
Is the balloon supposed to be, I mean, I guess more of a reckless childhood, or?
It is a...
Whimsical, I don't know.
It's not whimsical per se. It is, a lot of it is about childhood, or trying to hold on to that feeling of childhood, that happy-go-lucky feeling. Like if, as an adult, you know, we have our highs and lows, and it affects us sometimes from day to day. But as a child, it seemed like nothing affected me. I was happy regardless.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was talking about this with somebody the other day about how children have no, like, I mean, like, how children can pick up language so easily and how they can, you know, I don't know. At one time I was at a ski resort and I was having a lot of issues skiing because I'd never skied before. But all these kids were just zooming past me and they really have no fears or, you know, they don't have any ideas about the world like adults do. And even, I don't know if, like, the little figure here is supposed to be used as a kid, but it seems a lot more free than the larger figure.
Yes. So it is about fearlessness and taking leaps of faith. Our minds don't think that way when we're young. We feel like we can't get hurt. We feel
take
like
a lot more chances.
Yeah, we feel like whatever we dream about is going to come true. That's just how it is. Until somebody comes and shuts it down. And
that's the real world.
Transforms our mind.
Well, you're a father.
Yes, father of four.
Father of four. So you are also have raised and are raising kids.
Yes.
And so how do you guide them through that process of believing that anything is... I don't know how you do that. I mean, how do you also set them up to dream and to be, you know, dream big enough that they would live into what they can imagine, mm-hmm. and also get them ready for the conditions of the world?
So number one, I have very open dialogue with my kids, and I've always had.
What's the age range of your kids, by the way, too?
So my oldest is 24. Mm-hmm. That's Aaron, and Robin is 21. She's a senior at Loyola. Preston is 19. He's a freshman at Rice, and Layla would be 7, and she's in first grade.
Yeah, that's a good range. That's a good range.
Yeah.
So I interrupted you, though. I'm sorry. So you said...
No, it was... We talked freely. And I talked... You can learn from people that raised you in two ways. Because you saw what worked with you, and then you saw what didn't work. So... I wasn't raised with a bunch of, hey, let's sit down and talk about this. It was, to put it bluntly, I remember, I don't know, 16 or 17 years old, and this was my father's sex talk. Hey, you getting some pussy yet? Like, who?
Did I have to laugh at it first for it to
no,
be like,
look.
Because you were like pausing. You're like, wait, it's starting to get funny.
I'm telling you, and that was... And I was so taken aback just by that approach.
That's a wild approach. Right?
That I, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, we never had any real talks. You know when we had real talks?
How old were you?
I was 16 or 17 at that point.
Oh, so you knew.
When my father, he passed in 2000. So the 2 weeks before he passed, those are the only real conversations. I wouldn't say the only real conversations. But like the most honest conversations I had with him was before he passed. But coming up, no, there were no talks and lessons and let me show you this and let me show you that. But with my children, we talked about everything. Everything. And even still today, you know, I have young adults. And I text them every morning. Not every morning. I used to text them every day, but I'm their biggest cheerleader. I critique them, and I try to uplift them, and I try to give them the stuff I learn. Like the biggest thing I ever tell my oldest, and we used to butt heads a lot, because she's the most like me. I would tell her, like, if I made this mistake, why would I let you go down the same road? And she would say, I need to make my own mistakes, and I need to learn, I said, but I already did this, so you know you don't have to do that. So, you know, do something different. If I say it's some dog shit right there, don't step right there, why would you step right there?
Sometimes people gotta step in the dog shit themselves.
Yeah, I figure that shit out.
You're a solid dude, man.
Well, thank you.
No, it's visceral. You know, it's tangible, and it's really refreshing to see. You know, you're also one of the most disciplined artists I know, and I appreciate being privy to some of what you make, but you are in the studio and creating a lot.
Yes.
Now, like today, like you are, I mean, a little about your practice now.
I still do the, let's do our homework, me and my daughter. And when it's time for her to go to bed, if I'm reading her story, I read her story. And my studio's in my home now, so it's almost like reliving it again, like when I was back in the days. And when she goes to sleep, I go downstairs and I work. So sometimes, depending on what's going on, it can be a half hour. Sometimes it can be 3 hours, because it's you don't want to force stuff. I mean, you know this as a creative person. Either you feel it or you don't feel it. I put on some music, and hopefully I get worked up to a point where, all right, I'm in a zone and I'm working.
But part of it's showing up, right, to the studio or to, like, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that itself is like, even if I'm not, you know, if I show up, then I could push myself to get there.
Yeah, it's almost like going to the gym.
That's right.
People that miss a couple of days at the gym, the next thing you know, like, man, I haven't been to the gym in 2 weeks. It's the same thing.
That's right.
How have your sources of inspiration changed, or I guess stayed the same since you?
So most of my inspiration comes from everyday life and everyday people. And I love telling stories, whether it is through writing or through painting. And I've been privy to, I'm a good listener, so I've heard a million stories. And I love talking to people too. It's crazy, I hate people.
You wouldn't know.
Welcome, you're in good company.
Yeah, I hate people, but I do, they're fascinating, people are so fascinating. So outside of my own personal stories, I do like to listen to a good story.
Do you subscribe to the idea that you have to be sad or, you know, in experiencing something painful in order to create?
Not all artists. I'm one of those artists. I take that energy and I try to create something beautiful out of sadness. But I think a lot of the great artists, man, they do, unless you like been through like real stuff. Yeah, I don't think you can create like real work, or at least if it's not personal, even if it's secondhand.
But can you be happy and make art?
Yeah, there are a lot of happy artists.
Where?
There are a lot of happy artists. There are some happy artists.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
What do you have coming up that the city can look forward to?
In December, I'll be in Miami with our collective Pigment International. So we'll be there the first week. So that's like Miami Art Week. And I think Basel starts toward the end of that week. We'll be down there from December 2nd until whatever that Sunday is. I'm supposed to do a show at Blanc Gallery next May. That's on King Drive. Mm-hmm. And I'm still trying to talk Gashard and doing this abstract show in March. We'll see how that goes.
Great. And where could people find you on the internets?
On the internet. So my website is Paul Branton. BRANTON.com. Although I'm really horrible in keeping it updated, because I'm creating new work like every day. I need somebody to manage that for me.
Internship opportunities. Yeah.
Urban Menta on the gram and on Twitter. So Urban Menta, like years ago, back when AOL first started, when I left school, I wanted to start this company called Urban Mentality. But AOL only gave you like a certain number of characters. So it became Urban Mensa.
That's funny.
Yeah. And it stuck.
And yeah, it's been Urban Mensa ever since then.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, man, for being
thank you.
In the YCA space. Thank you for being on the Corner Store.
Thank you.
And just, you know, thank you for continuing to bless us and the city with your important work. Really, really, I'm grateful for you.
There's more to come. I appreciate you all.
Thanks.
We want to thank, of course, our engineer, Ernie.
Yeah, shout out, Ernie.
We want to thank our snack tour, Max. We want to thank Hopewell Brewery. We want to thank Essential Water. We always want to thank the sponsor of the Corner Store, Stolen Spirits. Yes. And we want to thank YCA for hosting us and our audience for coming up to tonight. Yo, we want to thank DJ Exist for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the art.
Big ups, Todd Manley at WGN Radio.
And Max and Dami, the Corner Store interns.
Salutes to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
You can keep in tune with the Corner Store at cornerstore_pod on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
Also, you can stream and download the Corner Store wherever you listen to podcasts.
And please rate and subscribe and comment on iTunes.
Please, y'all, consider giving us those 5 stars.
Thank you for listening.
We're going to see you next week.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.